Blog Talk Radio. Good evening. Thank you for joining us at the Wise Women Media, the radio show. And that was the incredible John Butler Trio playing his wonderful piece of work called Ocean. And that was the short version. There's plenty of long versions you can find on YouTube. We want to definitely welcome our guest. She's going to be on the line with us in just a few minutes. I did want to make a few announcements. You can find us online at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. You can find a list of our sponsors there. There is a GoFundMe link if you would like to donate to help keep us on the air. We also have links to our social networks, and all of our previous shows are also archived on the site. We do have a Facebook group, a Facebook page. We are tweeting at Wise Women Media, and we have a Tumblr, which is brand new, at Wise Women Media. Also, at any point in the evening during this interview, you can give us a call at 213-816-0357 to ask any questions that you have. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Nancy on the line. Nancy, are you with me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just great.
Excellent. Great.
Thank you for agreeing to be on the show. And we have clear weather tonight, so I don't think we're going to be interrupted by lightning or anything like that. No technical difficulties. And I just wanted to let people know that you work with Oceana.org. I'm going to spell that OCEANA.org. Which is an incredible website, lots of valuable resources. So tell us a little bit about what you did before you went to work for Oceana.
Sure. Well, first off, thank you so much for having me, Anita. It's really a pleasure to be on. I know we were connected by Dee Dee Shelton, who runs Hands Across the Sand. She's a good friend to both of us, so I really appreciate your time. But before coming to Oceana, I worked for another environmental nonprofit called Environment America. I did a year as a field organizer with a subsidiary of Environment America, Environment Connecticut in West Hartford, where I was working to pass climate change legislation as well as working to restore the Clean Water Act. So I did that for just over a year. I ran a couple of campaign offices where we did door-to-door canvassing and fundraising for the work to restore the Clean Water Act. And then I've been in Washington, D.C. since, first working with Environment America as their public lands advocate, lobbying to protect treasured places and national parks around the country. Oceana since then.
So where exactly are we now with the Clean Water Act? I get so much information, it's hard to discern exactly where we're at and what's happening with that. Can you kind of give us a rundown?
As far as I know, it's not my area of expertise anymore, but certainly, so when back in 2002 and 2008, I believe, there were a couple of Supreme Court decisions that really rolled back the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. As I'm sure you know, the Clean Water Act was put in place in the 1960s as the premier legislation to protect all waterways across the United States. Unfortunately, these Supreme Court decisions really narrowed the scope of what it meant essentially to be defined as a waterway in the U.S. So it put into question whether wetlands were still considered waterways and certain tributaries and streams of larger waterways. So that basically allowed big polluters to dump into waterways at their discretion because the bodies of water they were dumping into weren't necessarily defined as water of the United States. So the work that I was doing in Environment America was originally to pass legislation when we realized we weren't getting anywhere pushing bills through the House. We switched our tactic to be trying to implement an administrative fix. So getting the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to pass to propose a rule that would clarify what water is defined as in the United States and make it so the Clean Water Act applied to wetlands, tributaries, and all waterways in the United States. So we worked on that for a number of years, and just last, now you're testing my memory here, but I believe it was last spring, the EPA administrator at the time, Ms. Jackson, Administrator Jackson, passed a rulemaking that would put into process the administrative action to redefine the scope of the Clean Water Act. So that went through a public comment period, and I believe now it's going through the internal checks and balances to put that rule into effect. And hopefully, I think we have good reason to believe that that will be codified before President Obama leaves office.
So I think we were talking about Lisa Jackson. Is that the same? Because
yes.
She did a
yep.
lot of, she was doing a lot of appearances down in Louisiana after the Gulf oil spill. So I think that's the same Lisa Jackson. And your specialty is also on offshore oil drilling and, of course, renewables in the way of wind. What is your take on what happened in the Gulf of Mexico and clearly what's happening in a lot of other places now around the globe, unchecked oil drilling, and definitely the accidents aren't talked about. And the continued use of dispersant. What's your take on that?
I mean, the BP oil spill disaster was an enormous travesty. I think one could argue that it was the biggest environmental disaster of our time. Before that, we had seen a major oil spill in 1989 with Exxon Valdez. But to put it in perspective, the BP oil spill spewed 20 times as much oil. That's upwards of 200 billion barrels of oil into the Gulf. So it was an enormous environmental disaster, the effects of which we still don't really understand. There have been numerous studies. So this was in April of 2010. So it's 4 years later. We're finding dolphins still dying and washing up at record numbers. There have been studies released just recently showing that the tuna in the Gulf are suffering heart abnormalities. The studies haven't been published yet, but contextually we're looking at oyster declines, shellfish declines, the tourism suffered steep declines immediately after the spill, and the tar is still washing up. It's washing up as far as Pensacola, the giant tar mat just washed up recently. So we're not going to know the extent of the impact of the BP oil spill for decades to come. I can tell you that we're still suffering in Alaska from the effects of Exxon Valdez, and that was 25 years ago. So, this is all, it was an incredibly sad and incredibly heart-wrenching moment when this happened, and the Deepwater Horizon drill rig exploded on April 20th, 2010. Oil was still gushing, up until June 15th, so that's 87 days of oil gushing into the Gulf. The positive side of that is that I do think it was a huge wake-up call. Prior to the BP spill happening, the president President Obama was poised to open the East Coast to offshore drilling. When that happened, that put the brakes on a lot of the expansion. So at this point, unfortunately, we are at a point where the administration is considering opening up the East Coast and western Gulf of Mexico, as well as parts of Alaska, they're considering drilling. They're considering opening the coast to offshore drilling. It's a shame that we have such a short-sighted, that we need a gigantic disaster like BP to halt things, but that is the crux of the work that we do at Oceana and the grassroots team, making sure that people remember what happened with BP, making sure that people know that the effects are still going on and we still don't know how bad they are, and most importantly, making sure that we don't repeat those mistakes on the East Coast and that we keep the Atlantic free from offshore drilling and instead pursue clean energy alternatives like offshore wind.
So the use of dispersant, I think, was one of the biggest travesties in the whole Deepwater Horizon disaster. And, of course, you know, I think it was Congressman Markey from Massachusetts that said that the Gulf of Mexico had been carpet bombed with dispersants. There was so much dispersant used. It was just incredible. And, of course, when you mix the dispersant with the crude oil, it makes that whole toxic sludge 52 times more toxic. And I just want to remind people that if you want the playbook on the Deepwater Horizon and what happened legally and everything afterwards, it is super necessary that you read Dr. Ricky Ott's books. She's a toxicologist that was living there. She was a victim of that Valdez spill, and she wrote about it. And unfortunately, the Gulf, BP used everything that happened up at the Exxon Valdez as a playbook on how to deny what was happening to the people. And it was just Dr. Ricky Ott still speaks and still tours and been trying like the devil to get her on this show, too. So tell us a little bit about how we can move from the dependence on oil, because this is, you know, I think it's really something to hear people say, okay, we're all addicted, all we need to do is ride a bike, and I get that from so many people, and I go, well, that's not even a practical solution, especially for people that, you know, live in rural areas, or they don't have public transportation in so many places, so that's not going to work. But we're looking at a dependence on oil that Derek Jensen, the environmentalist and author, says 90% of it is used by huge corporations. So when you look at the 10% that's probably used by you or I or anybody else that's driving a car, that seems pretty small. But what do we need to do? What do you think are some of the things that we as a nation need to be doing to transition from oil to renewables such as wind, geothermal, and solar? And why does our government not allow, our local government and our energy companies not allow solar to be widespread and to be affordable? That's the big key here in Florida. People can't afford solar. We certainly have enough of that energy. Have you got any take on that?
Well, sure. I mean, I think first of all, you know, I don't want to count the change or discount the changes that we can all make on an individual level. I personally am a big proponent of practicing what you preach. So I would feel disingenuous if I were up here in Washington D.C. advocating for clean energy solutions if I also wasn't making lifestyle choices like riding my bike when I can and taking public transportation, just in general. Using a whole lot less energy, because I do think that is the biggest the biggest opportunity that we can take, both on an individual level, but also on, you know, the larger scale, government level and state level. We can just use a lot less energy and be smarter about what we use. And a lot of that is through energy efficiency improvements and just making new and existing buildings a lot tighter in terms of the energy that they're using. When we're talking about getting our energy from cleaner sources, from renewable sources, you're absolutely right, Anita. We're at a vastly undertapped resources. In this country, though, at this point, I believe it's about 1% of our energy electricity that we use, comes from renewable sources. We haven't even begun to see the potential of sources like solar and wind. That said, the solar industry is one of the fastest growing in the United States, and in the past few years alone, we've seen the industry grow exponentially. Certainly, I think the issue of expense is a problem. It is more expensive to get solar and wind up and running. But a lot of that is because of the way the energy industries are subsidized in this country. So, for example, oil and gas receives a huge amount of tax breaks and subsidies, whereas solar, wind really doesn't get anywhere near the kind of subsidies. So at Oceana, we have been promoting something called the investment tax credit, which basically would help ease a lot of the startup costs for wind companies and help them with some of the upfront costs for getting that energy up and running. I think your question, though, is speaking a bit more to funding solar on an individual level. Solar is not something that we as an organization actively promote because, you know, we are Oceana and we work specifically on ocean conservation issues. However, personally, I have been very impressed with the advances in funding for solar. No problem.
One of the things is homeowners here in Florida especially have a real problem just even getting a solar hot water heater or refitting their homes to solar. I mean, it's up into the thousands of dollars. It's just not even something that most people can afford. So then it's relegated to the people that have money that can do it, that can actually retrofit their house for it. So that becomes a real, real big issue. And the fact that, you know, we can look at countries like Germany that are using something like, I think it's 76% of their energy is from renewables, not all solar, but definitely wind and other methods too make up that 76%. So it's just such a disparity that they're already doing it and we're so far behind.
Sure. Yeah. One of the great parts about my job is that I work with five organizers who are based in states along the East Coast. And I was visiting my colleague Randy, who is our Southeast organizer based out of North Carolina. We had the opportunity to visit the Clemson Wind Drive facility. It's basically a facility down in Charleston, South Carolina, where they test the turbines to that eventually, once we get the policies in place to allow this, we'll be able to put these gigantic wind turbines off the coast. One of the things that that really stuck with me when we were touring this facility is that all of the brilliant research that they're doing at Clemson University is not going to be used in the United States given the current political climate. All of the brain power is essentially being used for technology that is going to China and to Germany and to Denmark. And that's great. You know, I am full of full advocate of countries moving, pushing the bar forward and moving ahead with clean energy. But it's just such, I mean, it's a shame. It's a really big shame that we have all this research and money going into producing these amazing technology, but we don't have the political will yet to make it a reality off our coast.
That's why I think it's so important what you said before. Whatever we can do on a small scale individually is you know, what we can do. And you know, what we can do, and like, for instance, I lived in D.C. for an eight-year period, and for 4 years I lived in the suburbs, and I did have to have a car to get to work, but when I moved into D.C., I loved it, and I love the city, so I envy you for being there. It's just an incredible place. I lived there for 4 years right on Connecticut and Military Avenue, and I was the bus stopped right outside of my building, and I was literally a third of a mile walk away from a metro stop. So
wow.
I had my choices, or I could catch a cab, but more often than not, I took the train, the metro, took the bus, and didn't own a car. I got rid of it when I moved into the city, and I did not need it. And I found that that was just an amazing way to live, and it saved me a lot of money. It was very practical. But now I live 35, 40 miles from the nearest large city and 15 miles from the nearest small town, and there's no public transportation. I mean, I'm out in the woods. So what
yeah.
what a different way to live. And it's there's a lot of places here in this country, and it's almost like it's been arranged by design to be like this in certain areas. What do you think about that, increasing the public transportation, and how do you think that that would be challenging in certain areas?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's public transportation. That's one of the things I would say is a big personal passion of mine. I was born and raised in New York City. I lived for a year in Hartford, and I've been in Washington, D.C. for many years now. And you can talk to my friends, and they all tease me for this, but I actually don't have a driver's license, and I don't own or drive a car. I get around most of the time either on my bicycle or today I was feeling a little bit lazy, so I took the bus into work, and I just feel a tremendous amount of freedom with it. You know, I have friends who are bemoaning the fact that they've got car payments or they got a parking ticket or this, that, or the other thing, and I don't have to deal with that stress. I fully recognize that that is not a viable option for a lot of people in the United States, but for me, it's been great. I would love to get to the point where everyone has the opportunities, like myself, to either take public transit or to use some alternate transportation, whether it's walking or biking or using a biofuel-powered car. I do think, though, and like I said, one of the perks of my job is that I do get to travel and see other cities. In the few years that in just the past few years, though, I have seen remarkable increases in public transit, and the bike share system is actually something that I don't know if they have it anywhere near you, Anita, but it's a fantastic opportunity where you basically rent bikes, and you don't have to own it, but you have a membership with in DC it's called Capital Bike Share, and you're able to check out a bike and dock it in one of the other many places around the city that have the docks. I was visiting Chattanooga just last week, and it's pretty deep in the south, and they've got a bike share of their own. So from the Bay Area to Chattanooga, Tennessee, we're seeing that pop up. There are also a lot of rideshare companies that are popping up as well. Zipcar is getting a lot more popular. I just think, and it's something that's very heartening, is that people are realizing that we don't have to do things the way we were we were told to do. You know, it doesn't just because we were told that the American dream means a big house, a couple of kids, a dog, and a big car. Doesn't necessarily mean we have to do that. So I actually am very encouraged to see the way that particularly cities are moving towards alternate transportation to cars, and I think that's a way that we all can really make a difference on an individual level, but I also see business playing a big part in transitioning to clean energy alternatives and changing the way we use energy.
I'm not sure if any of those efforts are going on in Tampa. I haven't heard of any of those, the bike share and the Zipcar, I have not heard of. That's not to say that that's not happening in some shape or fashion. I know there is ride shares, you know, where people are actually sharing rides or carpooling. But, you know, we're here in the South, everything's done a little bit slower, and we're a little bit more old-fashioned, and it takes longer for these very cool trends to happen here. I know that the local environmentalists, including the Sierra Club, are trying to get a light rail put through Tampa, and what's happening with that is I think it's a great idea, but my big issue with the buses when you're down in the Tampa, St. Pete area is they don't come often enough, and more than often enough, you're waiting for an hour to catch a bus, which just is, it's just not conducive to getting to work, getting to a doctor's appointment, none of that. So I'm thinking if you're going to put a light rail going from Tampa to St. Pete or St. Pete to Tampa, which is over the bay, you've got to have a bus infrastructure that's going to support getting people to and from once they get off the train. If you don't have that, then the train isn't going to work, you know, because it has to be able to work on the end. Like, you know, being in D.C., when you get off the train, sometimes you have to catch the bus to get to your destination once you get off the metro, and you have a transfer for that. At least that's how they used to do it, or you'd get a transfer from one bus to the next. So I'm thinking along those same lines in the Tampa-St. Pete area, and I'm not sure how it will be resolved. I think it's a great idea, but I think a lot more work has to be put into getting people from point A to point B.
I agree with you. It's and I think that is one of the places that citizens can really put pressure on local governments. I have seen some of the biggest improvements in transportation in Washington, D.C. in just the past few years. And a lot of that is because of initiatives led by our governor, Mayor Gray. I actually have a friend, I'm at his house right now, actually, who works for the Washington Area Bicycle Association, which is a small nonprofit that works on bicycle advocacy. And through that organization and through the activists that he works with and the volunteers he works with, that group and that group of activists has been very successful in improving biking options and transportation options. There are other factions and other advocacy groups in the area that work on improving public transportation. We've got a trolley coming up in the next few months here, or streetcar. So I really see that as an opportunity for people to get involved with local government, and that's a place where you can really make a difference, because these are things that impact your day-to-day life, and that's what local government is all about, just improving the day-to-day transportation and city living. So I do think it's beholden on our local leaders, but it's also beholden on people. If you want better options in your community, ask for it. We've got the technology in place. We just have to make sure that there's people calling for it.
Right. Let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about the oceans. There's so much to cover. I don't know if we could do it in the time that we have left, but tell us about why we should be afraid about what's happening with the oceans right now.
Where do I begin? So just to give a little context on Oceana, we are the largest international nonprofit that is dedicated solely to protecting the world's oceans. In the United States, we work on three main issue areas. The issue that I work on is our climate and energy campaign. So we work to protect the oceans from the impacts of climate change. We work to stop offshore drilling from expanding, and we promote offshore wind energy. The other two big campaigns, the second one is our bycatch campaign. So as things stand, commercial fishing is very unselective. So when fishermen, and we're talking about big-scale commercial fishermen, go into the waters, the main methods they use to catch fish is not targeted to specific species. So the species that are pulled in, if it's not what they meant to catch, for example, if they're out there to catch red snapper and they pull up the turtle or a dolphin or even a different kind of fish species, they'll just chuck it back in. So that results in an enormous amount of fish and marine mammals and reptiles that are killed or injured and not eaten. So that's our bycatch campaign. And finally, we also work to stop seafood fraud. A big problem in the United States that's gone very underreported up until the past year or so is it's a very widespread problem, but restaurants and grocery stores will sell fish that's marketed as one species, often a more expensive species. But when you do the testing on it, it'll turn out that it's a cheaper species, something that doesn't get as high a market value. So that results in it's consumer fraud, and not pointing fingers, not saying it's that the restaurant or the grocery store means to do it, but the chain from the fishermen to our mouths is so convoluted, and there are so many opportunities for fraud to happen. That's a big focus of ours, and has been for just about a year now. So that's a little bit of that's the breadth of the work that we do. In terms of why we should care, I mean, the oceans make up 70% of the Earth. They're huge. They feed us. They sustain us. They cool the planet. You talk to just about anyone and ask them some of their famous or favorite childhood memories, they'll often involve a beach. I know personally being in Florida, I mean, who doesn't have a memory of just wading in the ocean or fishing or sailing? They're places where we can just really, I think, truly connect with the environment and with the world around us. I could probably go on for the rest of time, but I think the big thing is that people assume that the oceans are limitless, that we can continue to eat whatever kind of fish and do whatever kind of damage to the oceans that we want, and the oceans are so big that it won't make a difference. But when we look at the reality of that, that's just not the case. Most of the fish species that we eat in the United States are overfished. We're taking too many fish out of the water. We're being unselective and wasteful with the species that we are taking out. And we're exploiting and we're polluting the oceans at an unprecedented rate. We're getting to the point where we're seeing the effects and we're bumping up against limits. I think one, And to wrap up, we're at the point now where we have 7 billion people on the planet. We're projected to be at 12 billion by 2050, I believe. If we want to feed all those people, we need to protect the oceans. So bottom line, there are limits to what we can take out and what we can put into the oceans. And as everyone has some form of connection to these beautiful places, we need to all speak up and do something about that.
Yeah, you were talking about childhood memories, and I wasn't always in Florida. My mother was from New England, so some of my first memories were, right off of Cape Cod and that whole area. And then my father was from Detroit, so the Great Lakes are, we lived in Michigan for a time, so the Great Lakes were, a big memory. And I remember going to, it was always like a body of water, like you said. It was always some kind of body of water. And I remember, waterfalls and things like that from up towards the Canada and, Ontario and Quebec. So since all four of my grandparents came from there. So incredible places, just incredible. And even going up to Quebec and seeing the belugas right in my ancestral home, right swimming right there. It was almost magical, I can tell you that. So looking at the website, I just want to let our listeners know, if you go to oceana.org, you'll see all of this that Nancy's been talking about. And it's very issue supported. You can go in and look at any issue and more information about it. Definitely, if the population is going to explode like that, as we know it is, so many of the coastal areas of this planet depend on seafood to live, to eat. It's their lifeline. For survival. So let's talk about Fukushima. Let's just talk about that briefly. I'm not sure what you're hearing, and of course news is very scant, but we're hearing that there is a lot of pollution and fish kills over towards the western part of our country along the coast of California, Alaska, Washington and Oregon, and of course British Columbia and all of the that whole area of Canada. So tell us what you've heard, and is Oceana involved in that at all?
Yeah, so Oceana is an international organization, but we do not have any offices in Asia yet. So that is not a specific issue that I can probably shed too much light on. I just think, for me, Fukushima was another big wake-up call, like the BP oil disaster, where, we have to be more conscious about where we're getting our energy. And nuclear is one of those, again, this is me speaking for myself here, nuclear energy is one of those types of energy where we really don't know what the impacts are of the waste from it, the spent fuel rods, the potential of a nuclear meltdown. I mean, as I mentioned, I grew up in New York City, and there's a big nuclear plant, Indian Point, right? Maybe 20 miles from where I grew up. So it's not just Fukushima. We've got nuclear all over the United States. And unfortunately, a lot of the plants, particularly in California, are located very close to fault lines. So Fukushima is not just going to be something that Japan has to deal with, and the effects of the radiation on the fish in the Pacific, I'm sure, are being felt throughout the region. We really need to take a good look at where we're putting these plants, and I personally don't think we should be building any new nuclear facilities, because the ones that we got are you know, we're crossing our fingers and hoping that everything will be okay. Fukushima showed us that everything won't be okay. So I will stress the need for transitioning our country and the world to sources of energy like wind energy, like solar, making energy efficient, improvements to energy efficiency.
We have a plant here that's been closed down, and I don't think people understand that it's a ticking time bomb. If we have a hurricane come through here and the storm surge goes over 25 feet, it's going to go over the walls where the spent fuel rods are, and it's going to wash all that irradiated water right back into the Gulf of Mexico. So that's exactly where we're at. Like you said, our fingers are crossed that the big one doesn't ever happen. But every time we're in hurricane season, which is right now, you know, that's basically what we here in Florida are doing. We're like crossing our fingers, hoping that this doesn't happen and that we would have to evacuate.
Right.
This is a closed down plant. This is not one that's operational at this time. But those fuel rods are still there, and so is the cooling pools. Those still exist. So that's
certainly
a big one right there. So definitely know what you're saying.
Let's
talk a little bit about the seismic testing, the air gun seismic testing. We're kind of getting down into the last 15 minutes, but I wanted to make sure that we covered this. Tell our listeners
great
a little bit about what that is and what's gonna, you know, what can happen with the animals because
yeah
of that.
Great. Yeah, so this is one, I would say 90% of my waking hours are devoted to the seismic testing issue, so thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about this. Back when we had the BP oil spill disaster, as I mentioned, the president was poised to open the East Coast up to offshore drilling. BP happened, he put a halt on that, and right now, the Atlantic coast is off limits to oil drilling until 2017. If we have our druthers, it'll be much longer, but right now we're okay to 2017. However, in that provision, the president did green light a proposal to allow seismic air gun blasting. And essentially what seismic air guns are, they're a way to determine what kind of oil and gas resources are off the coast. Sound innocuous,
oh, okay,
but they're not. Yeah, so what you have is a ship that'll tow an array of seismic air guns, and they fire very intense blasts of compressed air down at the seabed. And they'll go down miles below the seafloor and bounce back to the gun, and it'll map what is under the seafloor and what kind of deposits are under the ocean. These blasts themselves are 100,000 times more intense than a jet engine. We've all been near planes. We've experienced that the roar of a jet engine. Imagine something 100,000 times more intense than that. And that's what a blast from a seismic air gun is. And that's not just once, but it's going off every 10 seconds for days to weeks on end. That's intolerable for any species. But for whales and dolphins and most marine wildlife, their vision is quite poor. So they depend on their hearing for navigating, to feed, to find each other, to mate, for everything. They need their hearing to get around. So you can imagine if these blasts are going off every 10 seconds for months on end, you're going to be disoriented at very least. So the Department of Interior, in this proposal, they released some scientific information as well. And their own estimates, their own study estimates that 138,000 whales and dolphins will be injured or killed because of this blasting. That's not okay. 138,000 marine mammals. So, and that includes endangered species like the North Atlantic right whale. There are less than 500 of those beautiful creatures left. And to
put that many whales and dolphins, in addition to all the fish and the sea turtles and sliver of marine life out there at risk from this blasting, is unconscionable. Not only that, it's the first step toward allowing offshore drilling on the East Coast. You talk to pretty much anyone who lives in a coastal town, who lives on the beach, who gets their livelihood from the marine resources, whether they're a fisherman or they are a charter boat captain there are so many jobs tied to marine resources on the coast. We can't afford to put the resources those people depend on at risk. So I could go on and on about all the resources we shouldn't be, or the reasons why we shouldn't be allowing seismic blasting off the East Coast. But unfortunately, the president has and the Department of Interior and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, they have put this process in place. And as soon as the next few weeks, we could have a decision and the government could start issuing permits to these companies to allow seismic testing off the coast. The good news, and where Oceana and our grassroots organizers have come in, we have, in the past 6 months in particular, have just been very successful in working with coastal communities, and we've gotten quite a flood of opposition to this proposal. So at this point, we've had 15 coastal communities from Bradley Beach, New Jersey, down to, you mentioned St. Pete. St. Pete is one of the communities, including 9 in North Carolina alone, that have passed resolutions opposing seismic testing off their coast. We've seen well over 150 national, state, and local elected officials speak out against this testing, as well as over 160 environmental and animal rights organizations get beyond the record against seismic testing and seismic urban use. So the opposition is there. We're growing stronger every day. If I can make one more plug for our website, if you go to oceana.org/seismic, that is where you can see the latest on our campaign. I actually worked with our online team a couple months ago to put up a map showing all of the communities and all of the elected officials that have passed something or signed a letter opposing seismic urban blasting off the coast. So it's growing, and we just keep working with these groups and these communities to make sure that their voices are heard. And at this point, we are working with to influence the governors and get Atlantic and East Coast governors to weigh in with President Obama and put the brakes on this proposal. It's just not.
I'm looking at the map, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
I love the way they did the legend. For anybody that wants to see it, it's oceana.org/seismic, the word seismic. And you'll pull up the page, which is what Nancy's telling us about. And it's a map that's been clearly marked with the communities that have opposed the seismic testing, that have developed resolutions, that have had major stories in their newspapers is even added to this. So very, very well done as far as breaking down what's happening on the East Coast of the United States. And wow, y'all put a lot of work into this, and I'm glad.
Thank you.
But what do we need to do next? Do we need to, we're, here in Florida, we depend on the beaches, the seafood. I mean, we're just one, we're just one area of the East Coast, but $85 billion tourist industry, and if we have seismic testing and fish kills washing up and dead marine animals, we're not going to have a lot of tourists coming here. So I think that's a major point for a lot of these places up and down the East Coast. If they have any kind of tourist industry at all, having this even happen would be, would be detrimental to their revenue stream for sure. I can't go without mentioning, how could this even be moral and ethic, you know? And my other question is the military the ones doing the seismic testing, or is it corporations and their equipment, or is it a combination of both?
So this is not the military. On a case-by-case basis, we've actually had several members of the military speak out against seismic blasting. This is one of the details of the campaign that gets me, I'm not going to say more angry than the others, but this is one that makes me real angry. So what happens is that geophysical companies will do these seismic surveys, and they'll sell that data to oil and gas companies. So it's not proprietary information. It's not the federal government going out there and figuring out one time what's there. Now we know. Now we have this information on the books. But it's information that they gather, and then they hold tight to their chest, and they sell to the highest bidder. So in theory, we could have, right now there are 9 geophysical companies that have submitted permits to the federal government to conduct the seismic surveys. In theory, we could have 9 boats out there at the same time collecting similar data and then selling that to the oil and gas companies. So if you can imagine, you're out there and seismic survey boats are all out there at the same time, or even if it's 2 at the same time, the noise that they're producing adds up, and it builds on each other. So if you've got a boat off the coast of North Carolina and a boat off the coast of Virginia and a boat off the coast of Florida, and they're all blasting at the same time, those blasts just add up on top of the other. Where's the marine wildlife going to go? So you have that as the issue. And this is something that I started with the Public Interest Network, and which is involved with the PIRG, the Public Interest Research Group. The consumer rights advocate in me gets really riled up about this, that it's not the information that they're getting. They're then making a profit off of it at the expense of all of these coastal communities that don't even have access to the information. So we're not going to see this data, but the oil and gas companies can pay for it, and we could see survey after survey after survey, year after year after year.
And of course, the animals and the oceans suffer as a result of this precious information that should be public record.
Sure. If we're going to do it, certainly should be, right?
Yeah. Wow, that's just mind-blowing. We're going down into the last few minutes, so I'm going to ask you a crazy question. Where
awesome.
Do you see yourself in 5 years?
Honestly, Anita, I couldn't see myself doing anything else. I wake up every morning and I go to work, and I get to say that I am working with a prestigious organization that is doing its darndest to fight climate change and protect the oceans. And I for myself, I don't see a bigger calling. Perhaps one day I'll go back to school and I'll switch to more of the science side of things. But at this point, I know climate change is the issue facing humanity right now, and to be able to work on that issue and work to try and stop it, 5 years from now, I think I'll be doing a pretty similar job.
And what do you say to the people that are the naysayers that say that climate change doesn't exist? I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail about who they are. We know who they are. But what would you say to them if they were standing right in front of you and you had to prove your point?
Sure. I mean, first and foremost, it's them versus 98% of all scientists. So who are we going to believe there? secondly, I mean, the proof is in the pudding. You know, it's we see
this year and the past several years that extreme storms are happening. We look at Hurricane Sandy that happened now going on 2 years ago. Communities are still recovering from that, and we're going to see superstorms like that hit with more and more frequency. We look out to the west, forest fires, droughts. The evidence and what scientists predicted would happen because of climate change is happening. And there are communities, you talk about Florida again, South Florida is so vulnerable to sea level rise. Norfolk, Virginia, so vulnerable. These are the communities that are susceptible to climate change, and we're seeing the impacts of that. So climate change deniers can deny all they want, but the fact of the matter is we're seeing the impacts of climate change, and we need to do something. And you talked about a moral imperative just a bit ago. I don't see a stronger one than doing something to protect communities from climate change. Let's say the 98% of scientists are wrong. Doesn't really matter. We're still seeing environmental degradation and damage at such a fast rate. We need to get off our butts and do something about it. And I think we're at the point though where most people in the United States believe that climate change is happening and think that we need something to do something about it. So really it's up to all of us that feel that way to get to the polls and vote. And vote out the people who don't believe in climate change, and vote in and re-elect and elect the people that are not only believe in climate change, but believe that we need to do something about it.
You know, a wise woman has told me before, and this is so true, and I find this as I get older, that she was so right. She said, once you know something is not right, is wrong, once you know something needs to be changed, then you have to be part of that change. You have the responsibility to try to change it. And I thought, wow, that's pretty heavy, and that's a huge responsibility. And the other thing that I think is important, and I think one of the female speakers, wise women, that changed my life when I saw her speak was Dr. Helen Caldicott. And I saw her tackle a few people that were really, verbally attacking her about climate change. And she looked right at them, right in their eye, and she said, how can you deny the science? You can't deny science. So that in itself was pretty heavy, and that's what these climate change deniers are doing. They are denying the science that's right in front of them, and they refuse to believe that it's real. So pretty heavy stuff there. So
it's
do you
true,
have any closing
but...
comments for us, Nancy?
Well, I'd like to add on that. First of all, I think that's a beautiful quote, and I try to live by that each and every day. But, if we're all shouldering that burden together, it doesn't become such a heavy burden. I think, we talked earlier about the changes you can make on an individual level. Certainly there are many that we all can do. The government, surely, both the local and the national level has an obligation to be promoting policies and putting in and making doing something to tackle climate change. And I think we're all heading in the right direction. I just think we all need to step up our game. But if we do it together, it makes it that much easier. So I love that quote, and I'll remember it. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Nancy, for being on the show with us. And how can people get in touch with you if they have any questions?
Oh, I would love that. My email address is N as in Nancy, my last name Pine. So that's P as in Peter, Y, N as in Nancy, E as in Easter, at oceana.org. I'm the grassroots manager for the Climate and Energy Campaign. Definitely would love to talk to anyone who's more interested in getting involved in our campaign. Other than that, check out our website, sign our petitions, call your governors, call your local officials, ask them to oppose seismic airgun testing, and just do your best to be an environmentalist in your day-to-day life.
Well, thank you so much. We'd love to have you come on again, Nancy, and thank you for a wonderful show. And I just want to announce to everyone, this archive is available for listening later. You can share the link. Check us out at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com and hit up the GoFundMe link, or get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. And we'll be back next week for another great show with a wonderful guest. And I want to close with a great song, another one by John Butler Trio, Treat Yo Mama with Respect. So good night, Nancy. Good night to all our listeners.
Good night. Thanks, Anita.
I look, you know I got a recipe, you know I cook, and I go poop on a good intent, you know I am, and I'm bound, but I surely obey, I own, I'm getting the job done like I know I should, get the job done like a mama do me too, only one thing can remember, she said, you gotta earn all of your respect, and I don't give a whistle with color of me, I say, all that shit don't bother me, only one of them that you still have a gift, you gotta treat your mama. I don't know.